Okay, this is the third talk in the series. This one's even more detailed about some of the aspects of using high-performance 3D graphics, which is popular in a lot of games, in the Metro environment. And it's not really the Metro environment that is the point here. It's more the fact that the Metro environment is available on a really broad range of hardware. And so if I've got 3D code that tends to be sort of optimized for individual generations of silicon because they have slightly different feature sets, how do I make a single application work across all of those? So in general, we're going to talk about the fact that, yes, there is this diverse range of hardware. We have a single API called Direct3D 11 to target all of those. But how do I make that single API run across all of the different machines, because again, what that acts as is a multiplier for my customer base. If I can add another generation of silicon to my possible users, that's another chunk of money that my my product can earn in the store. And yes, we're at the end of the day. Okay, so we already talked about this slide. The interesting thing to note is that, again, on the high-end side, you're going to have people who have bought gaming rigs. And these are graphics chips that cost, they're coming in boards that cost about $400. Some of them came out like last week. Very, very bleeding-edge, high-performance technology. On this end, people are not necessarily optimizing for the latest features or performance. They're optimizing for battery life so that I have more of an opportunity for my customer to have one of these machines with them at the time, and not have the battery be dead, which is bad for the experience. So historically, what happened is these graphics chips have evolved each consecutive generation by adding more and more features. It's kind of like the CPU side has added a feature kind of when they went from 32-bit to 64-bit. That was kind of the kind of feature boundary that was producing some incompatibilities. With GPUs, they've done that about every 3 years. So it was worse in the old days, like the last decade. They were adding new features every year. They've slowed down a bit. But the result of that is kind of what we used to have with DirectX, is we went from this, when we didn't have a GPU involved, to this when we did. There's about 10 years difference between those titles. Okay, so this is the landscape that we're in today, where these are the features that are guaranteed to be present in pretty much every graphics chip that's out there that will ever run Windows 8. So if you're putting a title in the store, target this feature set, you're happy. None of your users will say, it doesn't run on my machine. However, there is another generation of silicon out there called the DirectX 10 silicon, which added additional features to that basic set. And in some cases, it did things like increase the maximum texture size. So I can have a 2K by 2K texture here. I can have an 8K by 8K texture here. Then when we shipped Windows 7, we added this thing called DirectX 11, which added another column of functionality, like Direct Compute, which provides random access I/O. We had tessellation. We also added some new texture compression formats and texture linkage capability, which the older parts did not support. So to handle all of this, we added modes to the Direct3D 11 API that we call feature levels. And each of those, so that the API is always DirectX 11 syntax, but it may be operating in a DX9 feature mode or a DX10 feature mode or DX11 feature mode. And then depending on that mode, you get access to the corresponding features if you're on the right hardware. And so the way this looks in the API is there's an enum that lets you specify, like this, the range of feature levels that you want to support. There's actually a couple dot releases in between of those. There's 9.1, 9.3, and then there's 10 and 10.1, 11, 11.1. 11.1 was just added in Windows 8. And so the way you use this is you initialize the graphics pipeline and you give it the list of feature levels that you want to support. So that previous struct there, that was what gets passed in here. And then what happens is the graphics API looks at the list of feature levels, figures out which is the highest one that it can support, and then returns that here as the one that's actually in the machine. And so that's how you can basically say, okay, these are the feature levels that I've written code that I know my application will exploit, but I still want to know what is the maximum feature level that I should expect to be able to send information to the chip on that this particular card has. So if I've got a low-end device, it may return a feature level here of 9_1, and then if I passed in 9.1, I'll get 9.1 at this. If there are none that match, then this returns a fail, and that's not ever good, as in you will probably not get your application submitted into the store if it just crashes on launch on anybody's hardware. So what it means is that you need to make sure that you at least have a dialog box that comes up and says, this hardware is really too old for my application to run, or something, hopefully that won't get you in trouble with the hardware vendor. But you know, you don't want to crash. And ideally, what I'm going to cover today is you should be able to take your application and make it run even on the very, very basic Direct3D chips. So these are the ones I want to support. This is what I actually end up having to support of that list. Okay, so the trick is, what we recommend is, get a current machine. I mean, pretty much every machine that's been sold in the past probably 6 months has a DX11 chip in it, even like the new Ivy Bridge units from Intel. Those are all DX11 chips. Then you're covered, because you know that your machine's going to be able to use any feature that's out there. But when you first start writing, restrict yourself to the bottom featureless set and then build up from there over time. And the way you do that, well, then what we're going to be doing is potentially dynamically calibrating to compensate for performance, but that's going to be another trick. I'll show you how we're going to test for this in the next slide. But the basic way to do it is you can actually specify at development time by using the DirectX control panel, which is already installed on your machine, a Direct3D version number, a feature level in the dialog box. And what that will do is it will make that machine emulate, even though maybe it's a DX11 machine, it will emulate a DX9 machine. And so you'll be able to verify that your application actually works on that class of customer's hardware. Now, the thing I want to make clear is nothing I've talked about in this presentation has anything to do with JavaScript. JavaScript does all of this for you behind the scenes. And in fact, it's probably something you certainly don't need to worry about it through XAML either. But if you're using C# and you're calling Direct3D APIs, or if you're using C++ like I'm talking about here today, called Direct3D APIs, it is possible to write code that is dependent on a specific generation of silicon, and that's what we're trying to show you how to do, to manage that issue. And so this is one of the techniques. Now, the point about this emulation mode is that it's not guaranteed to be as accurate of a simulation of an older part as actually going and finding one. So this is where you may go down and find somebody's dust bin where they've got old 3D graphics cards in a pile, and stick one or two of them in your machine and make sure that your title actually runs on a real DX9 chip before you actually submit it for money. So now I guess you can see the conflict, which is how do we balance? On the one hand, I want to look at... Wow, that's just... I want to make my application use the most advanced features. Why? Well, because the reviewers and the other people who are putting stars at the bottom of my store page are going to be very impressed if it uses all those cool features, and they're going to give it lots of stars. But on the other hand, if I only use those advanced features, then it may not work on a system that doesn't have them. And then those people are going to give me 0 stars or 1 star on my review site. And so how do I balance off, you know, getting a good reputation versus a bad reputation? And the other point of this slide is there is kind of a correlation between performance and feature level, but it's not guaranteed. In fact, it's really not something that you should actually rely on at all, because what really happens is there are DX11 chips that just sold in the past year that are in tablets, very small tablets, very battery life efficient, that you know, have a performance level that's not too much higher than some of the most basic machines that are out there. So we have to deal with performance potentially orthogonally to the feature set. And so what we're, our recommendation there is going to be that we, you know, I'll talk about performance, I guess, later in the talk. But really, these are the two opposing forces. On the one hand, I want to make my advanced functionality look really, really cool so that the reviewers give me good reviews. On the other hand, I have to make sure that it runs on a full range of hardware or else I don't get much of an install base and I piss off some people that, you know, will give me bad reviews. So how do we balance these needs? And the answer is just more coding. So the development strategy that we're recommending here is, again, use the DX11 hardware, DX9 scale up, and then to handle the performance issue, one of the approaches that's very effective is to scale the complexity of your scenes. So if I've got a game that's using a lot of particles, I may choose to use a smaller number of particles for the machines that are less powerful. And it's possible to actually adapt the number of particles in the system based on my actual frame rate so that the decision-making process for how many particles to use is pretty much automated. We have some samples that show that. And then on the feature level differences, yeah, we already covered that. But the other thing that you can do is you can also vary the image quality. So in this case, you can see there's some detail in the terrain that's missing on that side. There's more bump maps and rough dirt on this wheel than there is on that side. And so this is an example of a developer that has gone in, you know, to great lengths to vary the complexity of their content to make it run on a broader range of hardware. It's a pretty brutal trade-off in terms of the visual style, but you get guaranteed gameplay, you get the experience that actually works in both cases. On the one hand, the player who's got a low-powered situation, maybe they're playing on the bus or on the train, they don't get quite the same quality of visuals, but they get the gameplay. On the other hand, when they go home at night and plug this and play the same game on their desktop machine with three graphics cards in it, they get the full benefit of having those three graphics cards in their machine. So one of the ways we do this is with this concept of texture quality. And the way it works is every texture that's provided to the 3D chip is typically organized in a multi-resolution format, it's called. It's called MIPMAPs, in which, for example, if I have a 1K by 1K texture, it also, in the same file and in the same memory image, contains a 512 by 512 version and a 256 and so on divided by 2 all the way down. Now, that costs me, if you take the power series, an additional 33%, theoretically, in terms of memory consumption, but it means that every image that I've got can trivially be scaled to a lower resolution just by selecting a different map from that list. In fact, what we have in the current load code that's in the samples, you can specify a parameter that will throttle the maximum size, and then the ones that are bigger than that size just don't get loaded into your game, and that user doesn't, they not only don't have to pay the performance costs of having those be rendered in real time, they don't have to pay the load time of them really being copied into your application either. And so, like I said, you'll get image quality results like we saw in that last frame, but it's very simple to do just by specifying this clamp parameter on what's the maximum level of detail that I want to provide for my particular asset. There are a bunch of other trivial techniques that you can use to vary the performance and trade off of image quality. And the first one, for example, is there is this concept of anisotropic filtering. And that's just a parameter that is, people see it on games today. It's called filter quality. And you can go into your options menu a lot of games and set that. But you could just go ahead and set that yourself. And it's really something that only affects the appearance of a texture on an object that's kind of at a grazing angle that you're looking at. But the values in that range from like 1, which is pretty much none, to like 4 to 8 to 16. And so the high-end chips will use a 16, and your low-end chips, you probably won't use any at all, which means you'll set it to 1. Another way to improve image quality is this concept called multi-sampling, where what really happens is the graphics chip renders effectively something like 4 versions of every pixel on the screen. It renders every pixel 4 different times to give you slightly different results, and then averages those together to provide a much higher image quality than you would have gotten just from one attempt at each pixel. But the number of times you redraw that pixel is selectable in the API. There's 1, 2, 4, 8, so on as options, maybe even 6. And so again, you set that to 1 for your low-end devices, your low-power devices, and you set it to 8 or 16 for the, 4 anyway, for the, the machine that's plugged into the wall with the kilowatt power supply. Another common technique, some of our samples demonstrate this too, is don't actually render to the native resolution of the screen. What you do is you create an intermediate surface to use as your render target that's smaller than the actual resolution of the display. And then you can, in many cases, you want to turn MSAA back on because that actually looks really good. But then when you're done with that image, then you stretch it up just with another draw call into the final swap chain that gets displayed on the screen. Now, if you're really good, once you've stretched it up, then you'll put all the HUD elements on, like the score and the crosshairs and the cursors and so on. Put all those on at native resolution after the original 3D content has been stretched back up. There's a sample, it's called post-processing. If you look for that on the SDK website right now, it shows how to do that. And it's a really great way because on a low-end device, you scale back down the size of your render target. The total number of pixels that it has to process goes way down. Performance goes up. Battery is saved. And all the consumer sees is things look a little bit more blurry on the low-end device than it is on the high-end device. Okay, and then of course, you can actually vary the number of polygons. Some cases, people will store multiple versions, levels of detail of a given object in their app package. And then on a high-end machine, they'll use the detailed version. On the low-end machine, they'll use the less detailed version. With DirectX 11, you can actually use tessellation to simplify that. You ship one asset, just use it on the low-end machine. But on the high-end, you can take each of the polygons in that asset and have the hardware tessellate each of those polygons into 100 smaller polygons that are all smoothly fit into that shape. And that way your objects will look kind of clunky and blocky on the low-end device, but on the high-end device, they look fine. And all you've had to do is turn on this tessellation mode, which theoretically at least has not required you to go through the effort of creating multiple versions of every object in your scene, which your art team will hate to do. So by using tessellation, you take some of the load off your art efforts. Okay, now I'm going to talk about some things here that I'm sure no one has ever done, but it's worth bringing them up because they have happened in the past. Sometimes we see people who are just executing code that doesn't need to be executed. If you've got something that doesn't change that often, like say at the beginning of a level, make sure it isn't being called every frame. And this is just like sticking a breakpoint in that, saying, give all my logic that I've done, it could be happening, so let's be a little bit careful here. Another approach, things that I've seen happen, is that people actually end up accidentally calling their draw function twice every frame, which chops your frame rate in about half. So sticking a breakpoint in there and hitting F5 and saying, okay, is it the same frame? And then checking, that catches that one. It's rare, but it's one of these things that you want to make sure you find the easy bugs before you start doing the complicated performance optimizations. This is another point that people sometimes do is if you get the order of the routines in your run method that I had in last talk a little bit different, you can end up impacting effectively latency and effectively run it at what amounts to pretty close to a half the frame rate. Just from, like, if you render and then, okay, if you process all your input data and then render and then update state and then present, you'll be basically a frame behind. So that's another gotcha that I've seen people fall into. Now, once you're starting to look at performance here, it's interesting to find, okay, I'm trying to tune my product, find out what I can change to make it run on an even older or even more power efficient piece of silicon. It's important to do a few experiments to identify where the big bottlenecks are right away. And one of the obvious ones is that my game is now doing work. Some of it's on the CPU, some of it's on the GPU. Which of those is more close to the limits of that piece of hardware? It may be that my CPU is sitting around idle most of the time, just sending work to the GPU, and then the GPU is like totally thrashed and can't deal with more. Or it could be the other way around. And so the way you do that is you just slightly increase through some make work for, you know, while 1,000 do routine, stick that in either one of the CPU or the GPU, and if it doesn't affect performance, then you know that particular component or processor is not the bottleneck at that point. But then you know that the other one is, and you can start doing optimizations there to try to bring down the work that component does to bring your frame rate up. So let's say you do find that it is the GPU that's mostly the problem, then you've got access to all those options I talked about, like reducing the screen size, reducing the multi-sample anti-aliasing quality or the anisotropic filtering quality. And if those still don't work, you can also check to see if your meshes are the problem. So if you take one of your meshes, it's on the frame, you've got a slow part of the scene, maybe you double the complexity, put two versions of that mesh in there and see if they, the pixels will be the same, but the mesh will be double. And if that is what affects your performance, then you know your vertex is what's limiting you, and you'll have to do something like simplify the meshes in order to get your frame rate up. So this is kind of the logic that you go through this decision-making process. Is it the CPU or the GPU? If it's the GPU, is it my vertex engine? Is it my pixel engine? And then you can work on your way down to figure out where the bottleneck is coming from. And a more sophisticated way to do this is this PIX mode for Visual Studio 11. In Windows 7 and before, PIX for the PC was available as a standalone component that you could install that would profile your application. In Visual Studio 11, it's actually been integrated into the IDE so that you can visualize what's happening in the graphics pipeline, really. And so you can submit various types of events along with your data that's going to the graphics chip, and then you can look at the history of which those events get processed. That can be informative. But as I mentioned earlier in the last talk, the cool thing is this pixel history mechanism, where what happens is you can capture a frame, say. You go into some part where of your game and you see there's like a black smear there. What is that? And so you go where that frame is and you hit the capture mode. PIX will capture, effectively re-render that frame just without anything else changing, and capture all of the data that went into that frame. And then you can come back and browse through that data on a spatial basis so that it draws that frame for me as the pixels. And when I click on the pixel that has that black smear, then I can get a list at the side of the screen of all of the draw calls that affected, that grew over that pixel. And if there's some there that I didn't expect, like, hey, it's drawing like a tire smudge on that guy's face, or then I'll know that that's the problem. Or if I'll see that there's something that should be being drawn but isn't on that list, then I know, okay, well, that's because I'm not doing lighting of that guy's face. That's why it looks black, so, or darker. So that's a very useful tool. It also has a mode that lets you verify the state of the DirectX pipeline. The pipeline, we call it, is, you know, this set of stages where there's a vertex shader, a pixel shader. Each of those stages has got state parameters that can be set on it. And being able to visualize what the state of the pipeline is very interesting, because a lot of times with complex logic in your application, you can lose track of what you've exactly set in terms of state on the graphics API and what hasn't been set. And that's a very, it tells you at that point in time exactly what the state is of the pipeline that was being used to draw that object. And then, of course, you can also get a list of the DirectX objects that are being used, the textures, the shaders, the vertex buffers. Make sure that those are the right ones. And then you can also get your own call stack of CPU, your own. When you finally do render something, all of your own application functions that were wrapping that basic render call can all be analyzed here. So you make sure that you're drawing at the point in your own code that you really think you should be. So it's a very useful tool. The one gotcha for it is that I believe it currently requires a DX10 chip to run. So it's not perfect for optimizing performance on DX9 hardware, but if you find an issue on a DX9 hardware, you can set your switch back to DX10 and then fix the issue, and then you should be able to run on your 9 hardware again. Okay, so recognizing that these new low-power devices were going to be important, we made some additional optimizations in Windows 8 HLSL that you can take advantage of to improve performance on those devices. And again, the goal of this is to find improvements that help your performance but don't reduce the image quality of the result, so that you still get a chance of having your title look better than the competing title and get more downloads. This minimum precision is one of the more simple approaches in the sense that it doesn't actually require you to change any of your art assets other than some of the shaders. The way it works is that today most graphics engines execute all their pixel shader code, which is used for things like pixel lighting and bump mapping and reflections and so on. They use 32-bit floating point math for all of those operations. And it turns out that a lot of the math that you'd be doing in one of those shaders is combining colors that came from like an 8-bit texture. So if I'm combining a bunch of 8-bit numbers, why am I using 32-bit floats? It seems kind of overkill. So you can actually go in and specify minimum values for the precision to the GPU should be using at that point. And they're kind of like type declarations for any data type, except that they are they only specify a minimum floor. The implementations are always free to compute the results using more precision than you've asked for. So if I've got two 8-bit colors and I want to multiply them together, the system may use a 32-bit float to do that. But if I've told it that I'm okay with it using a 16-bit integer, then some implementation may say, okay, I've got a 16-bit integer, I'll do that in half the time. That's one of the benefits of this, is that if I can do 16-bit math, it goes twice as fast as if I was doing 32-bit math. So, for example, this shader has a bunch of parameters, these colors and so on, that are going, they're declared as floats, and everything through here is going to these float threes, these are all going to take 32-bit math operations to do. Now, if I want them to go twice as fast, because I know they're all colors, this is a shader from one of our samples. I think it's also from the post-processing effect sample. I change those floats to being min float 16s, min 16-bit floats. And what that means is now my chip can use its 16-bit math units instead of its 32-bit math units. And because it's register I/O bound, it'll be able to execute two of those in one clock cycle that used to be able to do one. And so I'll go twice as fast. Again, that's mostly the low-end hardware that's really going to take advantage of this, because they've got the low-end ALUs in there. And so your high-end system, like the guy with three graphics cards in his machine, they're not going to bother doing this optimization. It's just not significant to them. But the point to note here is that when I'm done, I still return a float 4, and that's because I'd like this shader to be able to pass its result to the next shader in the graphics pipeline without having to worry about what was going on inside it. There's not really any execution math happening at that point anyway, so it's not a performance problem. Okay, another characteristic of these low power parts is a lot of them use what's called tile-based rendering. And the purpose of this is to save memory bandwidth. Everything that's out there today is mostly gated by memory bandwidth, partially because that's what costs a lot of the power and generates the most heat. But in a typical renderer, I'm going to contrast a typical renderer and a tile-based renderer and see how the use of that tile as an interim cache means that less on-off chip bandwidth it gets consumed. In a conventional renderer, as we know, I'll have some list of commands that come through, and the GPU executes those commands and renders the results onto the image, and I'm pretty much done. And you can see that that's very simple, and that's kind of why people stuck to it. It's because it's very simple. But if you want to be a little more efficient in terms of battery life, you can use this tile-based approach. And that's where you take each portion of the screen, say in this case I've chopped it up into 6 pieces, and I render them separately. So what happens is the system actually traverses the list of commands 6 times and renders the image 6 times. And they can be very efficient. There's a bunch of optimizations where they don't have to actually traverse commands that they know don't fit in that little subwindow. But the advantage of doing this is I can potentially keep that 1/6 of the image in a little tiny cache that's on my graphics chip. So all the rendering that I'm doing there for that whole, I can render the whole scene into that little tile. It's the part of the scene that fits in that tile without doing any off-chip writes. And then when the tile is done, I can flush it out, which is just 1 write per pixel. The problem is in an average scene, when I'm writing, I'm actually doing read modify writes and Z-buffer compares and a bunch of logic into that cache that is very expensive if it's done over the whole front side bus, whereas if it's done into my little tile, it's all on chip and I don't see any of that going over the pins, which means I don't generate heat, I don't consume power. So that's kind of the motivation for that technique. You know, some of the complexity is that the implementation has to be a little bit more complicated, and there are some implications for you as a developer. What it means is that in the previous technique, if I wanted to use that partially rendered buffer as, say, an environment map and like texture it onto a chrome sphere to make it look like that's reflected in the sphere, I could just do that. In this case, if I did that and I was halfway through my scene, I'd only get 3/6 of the reflection on that environment map. So it would look pretty bad. So it can be a tricky bit. So what's happened is the graphics vendors that use tile-based chips have had to assume that you might be using that texture on your chrome billiard ball, pinball ball. And so they weren't really able to take advantage of the ability to, you know, they would do things like have to make a copy of that partially completed image. So the main thing we do now is we actually request that the graphics application specify that it's done with the rendering target when it's done. I mean, some applications do things like you're generating motion blur. Motion blur is probably a better example. The way you do it is instead of clearing the screen every frame, you leave the previous frame there and render a new frame on top of it, slightly shifted. And when you blend those together, they kind of look like streaks and blurs of like a cinematic effect. And if you're doing that, it means that you have to depend on the data that was in the previous buffer. In the case of these tiled parts, they never do have the completed buffer on the chip, at least. So for them to do that, they would have to make a special copy and keep it around in case somebody wanted to use it for that motion blur effect. But if you can tell them when you're done, hey, discard that buffer. I know I'm not doing a motion blur effect. I don't care about what you've done with that. Then it doesn't have to make a copy, and it can save a bunch of performance. So what we're recommending is that people explicitly call a discard view on the completed render target at the end of every frame. Now, our samples, I believe, should be doing that, but I looked last night, and I don't think they are. So we're bad. But I already sent mail on that, so hopefully that'll help. So in summary here, The objective is that Windows 8 now supports this broad range of hardware. It will run on all of them. But if you want to optimize your 3D application by using C++ and native code and Direct3D and shaders and HLSL, you have the option of writing code that is specific to those generations of hardware. And it can be challenging to do that, to take advantage of the whole range of expectations there. You can get, by using some of these techniques, a pretty broad range of hardware supported with reasonable performance on every type of hardware. One of the interesting techniques here is, again, I've said that just because a title is casual doesn't mean it has to have cartoon visuals. It could have incredibly photorealistic visuals, as long as you're careful about how much of those you use. Like I said, if it's a card game, billiards, pinball, pachinko, the complexity of the visuals is probably simple enough that you could use photorealism, depending on how well you model the reflections in each of your balls, and still be a casual title, and still not have a huge amount of work involved in the creation of that title. So again, this is the strategy recap for where we are right now. Start out on a DX11 card. Again, it's hard to not find. This is a DX11 laptop, for example. Most of the new machines are coming out are DX11. If I don't think you can possibly buy a graphics card at retail, for example, that isn't DX11. So when you're building your dev machine, put that one in. Then again, start out, make sure your application runs at level 9.1, because that is what the store will expect you to not crash on, at least currently. And then you can adjust at runtime for the actual performance that's in the machine, potentially by selecting the right texture level, selecting the right anisotropic level, and then also selecting the right feature level. What we'd like people to do is write products that span that whole range of hardware. And it may mean that you may not be able to fit them all in the same version of your app. As in, you may have to have a version for this half down and another version for this half up. But ideally, it would be a single code base and a single package that would have the ability to scale from the high-end SLI rig, which shows off tessellation and direct compute, all the way down to the handheld tablet device. And the way to do that is, take your DX9 solution and then add modes to it that exploit more and more of the advanced functionality and do things like tessellation at the high end. Because if you do that, then you're going to have a unique differentiating feature for your product relative to all the other people that are using cartoon visuals. Okay, and this is my conclusion slide again. That's the opportunity. This last talk has been how to, deal with the optimization problem for spanning a large different range of hardware, the bits are out there now. I'm using them. They work pretty well. If you've got any ideas for a game, I think this is really one of the times in history when it'd be a really good idea to get it out there and give it a shot, because the scale of the platform is unprecedented. So, like everybody says, check out the website and go build something cool. Thanks.